Essentially, I think we mentioned this on, we mentioned it on Friday, that we were trying to explain the, the Gemara that says that in the days of Ahasuerus, they were makabel with Ramahava. And we made the point that all the miracles that occurred on Purim were different than the miracles of Sinai, because there all it showed was the power of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it really didn't give them an opportunity to see the Derech of Chachma, to study the various lifestyles, to compare and to contrast the lifestyle of the Torah, of the Tzaddik, as opposed to that of the Rasha, because most people are naturally drawn after the Derech of the Rasha. That's what's appealing, whether it's like a Ahasuerus, the hedonistic, the instinctual, or Haman represents the desire for power, the egotistical. These are the natural attractions. So it's very hard for people to uproot these things. And it's also very hard to believe that these things, after all is said and done, not only are they false, but it's not true, it's not based upon true ideas, but beyond that, it can't succeed. That's what I want to really demonstrate a little bit today. I think it's the last pasuk in the first parak of Tehillim. It contrasts Ashrei Hoyish, Shalom Halach Batas Rishayim, Uvederech Hatayim La'amad, Uvemoshav Leitim La'yoshav. I'm not going through all the particularities, but we'll take that up one day. But essentially, the idea is to contrast the life of the Tzaddik to the life of the Rasha. And if I'm not mistaken, the last pasuk is Ki Yodea Ad Hashem Derech Tzaddikim, because God knows the way of the Tzaddikim. That means stays in line with the truth. But Derech Rishayim Toved. And the way of the Rishayim Toved is destruction. It leads, which means to say that the real flaw, aside from the fact that it's evil, the way of the Rasha, but it can't succeed. In and of itself, it's doomed to failure. And I want to try and illustrate that in the Megillah, because that's the idea of the Megillah, is to contrast the lifestyle of the Rishayim. Of course, you have Ahasuerus on the one side, but the more serious Rasha is Haman. As we learned, that's why Mordechai Layichav Layishtachaveh, he wouldn't bow down to him because this is a form of idolatry. He maintained that he had some kind of supreme power. It was an ideology of a Malik. But the Megillah describes the downfall. So I want to see what we can glean in terms of the downfall of the Rasha. Okay, so let's ask some questions over here. What caused the entire problem that came upon the Jews? The decree of destruction. What was it that caused the problem? On the surface, we try and understand. The Chumash, the Torah, it's something that should make sense to us. That, it has a certain reality to it in a way that we can understand, we can see it. On the surface, it's not that simple to understand that just because Mordechai refused to bow down to him, so Mordechai refused to bow down to him. All right. So that's the cause. But the effect, it's a major thing. I mean, this is, Paros Umadai was a major empire. And to enact such a policy across the entire empire for all the Jews to be destroyed, it's a major thing. So let's ask a simple question. Well, what was it so terrible? Why did Haman feel that he had to do this? Let's try and understand that on a logical basis. I mean, everybody, it seems that Chalam, everybody complied with the decree. All right, so he was somebody who loved power and honor and respect and all that. So everybody complied with the decree. except for one person. So why was that such a terrible thing? Why couldn't he tolerate that? I don't know if it's a question that we ask all the time, because on a certain level, you know, it makes sense to us. You know, he wouldn't bow down to him, so therefore he had to go after him. But why? No person, president or ruler expects 100%. He has a 90% popularity rating. It's very, very good. You don't expect every person in the universe to support you. All right, that's one question. But another question, if that's the case, if for whatever reason he felt, I'm not sure that it was a practical thing. I mean, I think the answer that would come to mind is that it was a practical thing. That if one person can get away with it, then others will get away with it, will try and get away with it. So he felt that perhaps he had to set an example. I don't know if that's the case. Now, if that were the case, so then, again, why did he have to resort to this whole plan to exterminate all of the Jews, which is a big undertaking? Why didn't he just deal with Mordechai? It's an interesting thing. In a certain sense, Mordechai, on a personal level, gets away with it, because Mordechai didn't change his behavior from that point on. Even after the decree goes out, Mordechai still refused to bow down to him. He didn't try to make any kind of changes even after the fact. I mean, Rachel gave share yesterday on you know, what his decision was, why he paskin that this was a Avodah Zarah, and it's a matter of Yehar Gal Yavo. And it was a very courageous psak. And he put his own life on the line, and he risked the life of all the Jews. But you see, another dimension is that, okay, you could say that was before. Maybe he thought that he wouldn't be noticed. The truth of the matter is that it was theoretically possible that he could have gotten away with it, because he didn't flaunt this fact. Mordechai wasn't interested in flaunting the fact, in having Haman find out about it. But it says that the others, the people, would see that he was that he wasn't complying. They noticed that he wasn't complying, and they snitched to Haman. So even after the fact, even after it was, you know, Haman discovered it, and then Mordechai found out about the plan to exterminate the Jews, you might think that, okay, at this point in time, in order to save the Jews, he would try and do something about it, but he still didn't change. Now, that's my first question. So if this bothered Haman so much, so why didn't he just deal with him? Why didn't he force him to comply? Or try to, anyways. Or even kill him. Because he was violating the law of the land. Instead, he decided to deal with the Jewish people as a whole. Okay. All right, so I'm sure, anybody have anything to say? Get a little interaction at this point.
Could it be that Haman recognized that this was really the philosophy of Yehadus?
Yeah.
And therefore, just removing Mordechai wouldn't really remove that.
True. That is true. That's no question about it. That Haman recognized that this was not just an individual thing, a quirk. There's always people in any kind of a country that rebellious types. They won't go along. Nonconformist, whatever it is. Even in a time like today, you know, the whole country is unified, patriotism, the war against terrorism. There's always those people that are going to blame on the United States. No, there's always Michigan, was put that way. But if that's the case, that's a different situation. But that's not what Haman saw. Haman was very smart. And obviously he must have studied the situation. Well, he knew that this was not just a personal quirk. That this stemmed from a certain type of an approach, a certain philosophy he recognized. He recognized at bottom whether he recognized it consciously, whatever. He knew that it stemmed from the fact that he was Jewish, and that if he was to get rid of the problem completely, then he'd have to remove destroy the Jewish people. Okay. Still, bear in mind that I can see that point. But we don't know that there was any practical issue, because it doesn't mention that anybody else went along with Mordechai on this. That just to say that he didn't do any kind of test to see if the other Jews agreed with Mordechai. But nevertheless, that was his decision. Okay.
Like Morty's saying, but it seems that it's not maybe a question of whether other people also didn't bow down to him, because it seems like Bevy said yesterday that he, was the operative quality that Haman was that he thought that reality should conform to his will. So, but that only works for a person insofar as they're really able to see that reality does conform to their will.
So
when people are bowing down to you, right? So that's like one example of a reality of your will to be a god, reality conforming to that will.
Now, I know what you're saying.
It's true only Mordechai was the one who was resisting him, but he saw that even though Mordechai is the only one who's resisting him, but that's because the way Klal Yisrael views reality, right, is that it could never just be something that's going to conform to Haman's emotions. That it will always be a true reality. And it'll never be just the one that Haman wants it to be. So Mordechai may be the only one resisting, but because maybe he's the only one in Klal Yisrael that sees this particular halacha, but he sees that Klal Yisrael as a nation, the only reason Mordechai does this is because they as a nation...
So then you say that he recognized that it was an ideology, that there was a competing ideology. He had his ideology.
But the point is that reality, the fact that there are people out there who see true reality is an indictment of his own distorted reality. The person who's in a distorted reality, it only works insofar as they're able to be convinced that that's true. But if there's a true reality out there, they won't be able to stand up to it. So Klal Yisrael, their attachment to true reality means that Haman's ego, like his desire for his emotions to define reality, can't really function as long as Klal Yisrael is around. Because they're pointing out their existence. Their very existence points out that there's a true reality.
Okay, I'm not arguing with them.
So it doesn't matter who bowed down to him. You know, the bowing down just points to the fact that Klal Yisrael recognizes a true reality.
Well, I mean, okay, but what were the rest of the Jews doing?
So it could be that they weren't resisting.
If they were bowing down to him.
Right.
So let's face it, if Mordechai had bowed down to him, there'd be no problem.
Right. That's because then he would just be able to assume that they all think that he's really a god. But when Mordechai doesn't, he knows that the rest of them really feel the same way, and that's their belief. And they're just either they just can't resist him, or they don't see the halacha that way. But in other words, he sees now that that's truly their belief.
All right, fine. So let me ask you another question. I'm not arguing with that. You know, something to, you know, think about. It's still a little bit, you know, in terms of the cause and effect, that one person wouldn't bow down. All right, so you're explaining it. I mean, look, I'm not arguing with that. No question that's the factor, that he saw this in the Jews. He saw that this was something of the Jews, that they live by a different ideology. Now, let me ask you another question. So why didn't he go and kill Haman also? Kill Mordechai.
Mordechai wouldn't have been included in the Xero?
He would have. He could have forced Mordechai to comply for the meantime. He could have killed Mordechai immediately. Or, as it happens, he didn't do anything to him. He just let Mordechai's fate be tied in with the general decree. I'm sorry, what?
I thought Pshat was that Mordechai had a high position, and Haman couldn't just take him out by himself.
He couldn't just take him out by himself?
Because Mordechai was also a member of, like, Ahasuerus' court. I don't know
if that's the case. Where do you see that? The king didn't even know about I don't know if they knew about him. He would sit outside the, he would hang around by the courtyard, you know, and then he discovered the plot because he knew the different languages, as Rashi says. I don't know that he was a member of the king's.
Nah.
I don't know if that's the, but I'm not, the question, I'm just asking a question. Why didn't he deal with him? Obviously, it bothered him.
Right.
So now all you're saying is that he recognized that the problem was deeper. It had deeper roots.
Right.
And that there was a nation over here with an ideology that he simply couldn't accept. I mean, that was not amenable to his distortion.
Well, it could be that, in other words, Mordechai himself, once he realized that about Klal Yisrael, so Mordechai himself became like inconsequential, but Klal Yisrael became the real enemy.
Well, I can prove to you that it's not the case. You see, take a look what happens after the first party. After the first party, something happens, which is very strange. This would be in chapter 5, yeah. So, you know, after the 3-day fast, you know, the tshuva and Esther goes before the king, and he, you know, stretches out the royal scepter and all that, and then she makes a request, and the request is that him and how much you go to the party that she would make for him. Okay, so then the king agrees, and quickly fetches Haman, and they come to the party, and you know the story. He asks, so what is it? What is your quest? What is your request? I'll give it to you. At Chatiya Malchus, up to half the kingdom. And then, of course, she refuses to say what it is. She keeps the suspense going. And this is another interesting study, the strategy of Esther, why she didn't put her cards on the table immediately. What was she hoping for? What was the idea over here? But as you know, she keeps it hidden, and she just makes a request that if you find favor in the eyes of the king, so then let the king and Haman come to the mishta that I'll make for them. Tomorrow. So she's building up a tremendous amount of suspense over here. But then read the psukim after that. I assume you guys all have your Megillah in front of you.
Yeah.
And Haman went out on that day, Sameach v'tov lev. Okay? He was exuberant, as they translated. He was joyful. Very, very good mood.
Okay.
And when Haman saw Mordechai in the gate of the king, v'lo kam, v'lo zomimenu, and he didn't stand, nor did he even move, v'yimale Haman al Mordechai chema. Then Haman was filled with chema. With anger. I mean, not just anger, but he couldn't even control. He almost lost control of himself. But he said, Pak Haman, but he had a peso, and he had to seize all of his strength, you know, to keep himself from falling apart. And he made it to his house, by Yishlach, by Yahweh, and he sent out and he brought his friends via Zeresh Ishto. I mean, by Yisap Elohim, Haman is Kvod Ashrav, Yom Banav. So he starts off by telling him about all of his greatness and his wealth and how he's been promoted and everything. Then he says, and in addition, Esther didn't invite anybody except me for the party that she made. But all this is worthless to me. This is very, very significant. Now, according to what Yosef, you've been saying, that once he, you know, he had a solution to the problem, and the problem was really abstract. It wasn't personal. It was an ideological conflict. And then, as you say, that the Mordechai was not significant anymore, because which is okay. I mean, the idea is a good idea. I can hear that, but this would seem to contradict everything. Here, you see, it's very, very personal, and he's filled with rage. And by the way, this is really the beginning of the end, as far as the Russia is concerned, as far as Haman is concerned, because this night is very, very significant. I'll explain how. Even though it's not that obvious on the surface, because it seems that the next night. The next night they have the party, and And again, the king asks for a request, and, you know, then she says that she requests our nation, and the king said, who is it? And it's this evil Haman, and so on and so forth. And then he's filled with rage. And then that strange thing that happens, you know, he tries to plead for mercy, and then the king comes back and accuses him of trying to steal the queen, the whole thing. I mean, that seems to be the downfall, but and all the events that take place on that night, you know, the question is, how are they connected to the real downfall, which occurs the next day at the party? All right. I don't know if I can go into all the particulars today. I have a share on that, but just wanted to just make a general point. But over here, this is very strange to read, because what caused him to get so angry? This is nothing new. He knew about this before. This was the policy of Mordechai. It had been pointed out to him, and he had to have seen this many times. But apparently, he was able to deal with it. So, I mean, I agree with what Yosef is saying, that, you know, he wasn't like a kid. Obviously, he was a significant individual. He couldn't have risen to such a position. He wouldn't have been dangerous. And he decided he had to deal with this. And he arranged with the king, and they had the whole decree, and that was the end of the story. So why is he suddenly getting crazy now? It's like suddenly like he discovered something new. Oh, you hear my question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the question. I mean, aside, you know, you could raise this question even without. I'm not raising this question because I want to, you know, to challenge what Yosef said. The question exists on its own, stands on its own. Something that, you know, should be noticed as you're reading the Megillah. Then why is he suddenly getting angry? This is not anything new, and it's something he had dealt with before, and it doesn't mention that he really got angry the first time. It doesn't mention that. It's just Vayivez Diena Vlishloch Yad Marchalavano, that he had a response to it, and his response was to deal with the problem. So, okay. If that's the case, he was the kind of person that didn't take these things personally. He knew how to deal with his obstacles, with his enemies. But now we see a completely different situation. So what happened? That's the question. All right, you want to take a few seconds or what?
Yeah, okay, a few seconds is good.
I'm sorry, what?
A few seconds is good.
Okay. Mordechai immediately. And that also, I mean, you're just following the line of questioning that I've developed over here, that everything that happens over here on that night seems to be contradictory. Seems to be contradictory to the way he's been operating. Because until now, as has been pointed out correctly, he was satisfied. I agree with what Yosef said, that he didn't feel any need to get rid of Haman immediately. What difference did it make? He had it all worked out, the date was selected, and the entire Jewish people would be killed, and everybody, and that would be the end of his problem. Now, and I raised the question before. I mean, why did he do that? Make a plan to kill all the Jews, and then he still could have dealt with Mordechai immediately on a personal level, but he chose not to do it. But now he's changing his plan. That is to say, he's not appealing. He comes to the king that night. He's not appealing to, change the date. To kill the Jews, to do that more quickly, immediately. No, that stays in place. All he's asking for is to, well, his objective was, he never got really a chance. He never got a chance to ask for it. But he went there with that purpose, to kill Mordechai immediately. So, as I said, everything he's doing on that night seems to contradict. I mean, you know, I'm a Marashach. If he wanted to get rid of Mordechai immediately, he could have done that before. Just on that night, as a result of the advice. You see?
Could it be that originally he couldn't kill Mordechai because it looked like he had a personal vendetta? And people think he's a total egotist?
Right. Yeah, so then why is he doing it now?
I don't know.
Okay, but you're on the right track. Now, let me see if I can develop it. I think what Mordechai is saying is true. You see, essentially, you get an insight into the nature of the Russia. I mean, the idea that the Rajay was explaining and Yosef was saying it over this morning, and the idea that of a Russia, the idea that, that reality, he has some kind of a supernatural power, that all of reality is connected to his will, and this is like a raving lunatic. It's a total insanity, the Meshuggah. And so how, why would anybody take a person like that seriously? Now, there are people in the world that have these feelings. You know, it's just, but generally speaking, the world would say it's psychotic. The guy goes around saying, talking like that, and that he's a supreme being, and all of reality revolves around his will. People put him in an insane asylum. It's a joke. So what makes him dangerous? And there are many people, by the way, that have these kinds of megalomaniac feelings. Like R.J. said, there's a boundary line. I mean, at which point the egotism per se is a corruption, is an evil, but it's not defined as idolatry until it reaches a certain level of deification. See, but the real danger of a Haman, and you see that in all examples of Amalek, you see that in a Hitler, you see that in Arafat, is they have the ability to control the emotion. They have the ability to control the emotion and to camouflage the emotion and to make the egotism appear as though it's true idealism. And that's how they're able to win people over. Now, Hitler can't win over the Germany and other nations by saying, you should all follow me because I am God, you know, I'm the supreme being. I mean, it's crazy. Now, it's Germany. The whole cause is Germany. And Germany has been victimized by the world. World War One, they were standing in the back, and the German race is the superior race in German culture. We're fighting for the ideal. But the truth of the matter is that it's purely personal, it's instinctual in the end. You know, with Derech HaShem Tovei, if you go through, I gave a share on that too, you can see the what brought Hitler down. In the end, it becomes very clear to everybody that it has nothing to do with Germany. It was purely for him himself, because at the end, when he saw that everything was crashing down on him and he was losing the war, so then he had orders to destroy everything, to destroy the whole economy and the, you know, all of the infrastructure of Germany, because they're not worthy of existence anymore because they failed this test. And you can see that is to say that if it's not for his glorification, then Germany has no value whatsoever. I mean, there were other Germans that were nationalists that were saying that, you know, you have to accept the reality and we should prepare the people for defeat and we'd have some kind of future. Germany should have a future. And the same is true with Arafat. You know, he's able to convince the world that he's fighting for a cause. And on the surface, it seems to be, you know, to the world at large, it seems to be reasonable for his people. They're displaced and self-determination, they should have their own state and this and that. But the truth of the matter is, many people finally are beginning to realize that that's absolutely nonsense. He had every opportunity with Barack. He made an offer he could have had. If he really cared about his people, then why is he allowing them to be killed and slaughtered and in poverty? I mean, Israel is willing to make a deal. He could have you can't say it's because they're only offering 96% and not 100%. I mean, a person that really cared about his people, look the Zionists, the Jews, they wanted the whole land of Israel too. But they were fighting for a state, for the people, for the Jewish people, according to their perception of what was necessary at the time. So there was when the United Nations had the idea of partition, so that was against the whole Zionist faction, because they said that the whole land of Israel belongs to the Jews. But they accepted it practically. Look, let's take what we can get, because we will establish a country, we'll have an economy, whatever. We can't have the whole country. That's someone that really is fighting for a cause. I'm not going into the underlying, but I'm not saying every Zionist is the perfect subject. I'm not saying that. But the point is, there is a reality of the cause. But the Russia, there's no cause. The cause is really just a means for him to express, to satisfy his own egotistical need. Because it's got to be through the medium of a certain type of a cause in which that he identifies with. That's basically the way it works. So that's why I agree with what Mordechai said, that underneath it all, it was really the glorification of himself, but that he had to keep very, very hidden, because he's not going to get very far in the world, especially with the king. If the king finds out what he's really about, his genius, and there is a genius, there's an evil genius, was the ability to project the plans, which stem purely from his own personal desires and make it appear as though it was for the good of the kingship. That something which was purely subjective was really objective. And in fact, that's the, I think Rai Jay one time pointed out, you know, the idea to kill Vashti. That was Mamukhan. Mamukhan is supposed to be Haman. That's the name they assigned to him before he was promoted, Mamukhan. So Rai Jay said that was the same thing over there, that he was able to make it appear, even though it was for selfish reasons. For whatever reasons, he believed that this would be good for him. But he was able to convince the king that it was something that was necessary for the kingship, because he said, well, if she gets away with it, then all the women of the kingdom will rise up, lahavdos baleim b'aneim, and it'll have a terrible effect upon the whole system of the men having the upper hand and running the country and so forth. So the same thing over here, that he was very, very shrewd. He never said that this is a personal thing. He went to the king, and what did he do? He came up with something which was very, very convincing, that Yeshnam Echad, that what I'm doing now is purely for the sake of the preservation of the empire, because you have to realize it was a far-flung empire, and it's made up of all different types of souls. And it's very easy to understand in light of the situation today. Yeah, you see a lot of these, even in Afghanistan and Iraq, you have countries that are made up of different types of groups. So it's very dangerous if you're trying to control something like an empire, and there's one group that's not loyal, that has their own set of laws and their own ideology, and they're completely different. Yes, they don't live according to the laws of the land, because they have their own system which guides them in every way. And essentially, he was saying that they were disloyal. And he even offered to pay the money out of his own pocket. So what he's trying to do is to convince the king that everything that he's doing is purely for the sake of the kingship. That was his genius. That's why it makes perfect sense that in light of that, he wouldn't take action against Mordechai. Because that's the Vayivez Diena. I mean, he's very, very shrewd. You see that the Russia is dangerous because he's very, very shrewd. And he has the ability to control his emotions, and he has the ability to use Chachma, and he's able to convince people that what he's fighting for is really an objective good. That's the history of every Russia in the world. And those are the ones that are dangerous. Those are the only ones that achieve any type of success, even though it's short-lived. So that's why he wouldn't harm Mordechai. If he were to do anything against Mordechai, it would be pretty obvious that there's something personal over here. What do you care? So you see, he very consciously refrained from doing anything to Mordechai. So if that's the case, the question is even stronger. So what happened? Well, what happened on that night? He was in a great mood. And why all of a sudden, you know, now it seems like it's the first time in the Chose Einin Ushoveli. All this is worthless to me. Every time I see. By the way, this would also indicate, I mean, I'm sort of directing myself to what Yosef said before, that it wasn't so simple, that it was just this abstract thing. That he lived according to one ideology, that he, you know, reality conforms to his world. They have a recognition of the true reality, and it's like an abstract philosophical argument here. You see, it was very, very personal. So what happened that night? Any thoughts? I think this is the crux of the matter. In terms of the point that we're discussing, the Derech Hashem Tovei, it explains to you the downfall of the Russia and the difference between the Russia and the Tzaddik. You see, up to a certain point, the Russia and the Tzaddik have something in common. What is it that they have in common?
They both use their minds.
Yeah. And what happens if you use your mind, it means that what? And you don't use?
The emotions.
Yeah. The ability to control the emotions. I mean, you see, that's the greatness of the tzaddik, that he's able to control his emotions. And even though it's very difficult for Mordechai to, you know, the courageous Tzrak and to stand up to this danger, but he's in control of his emotion, and he lives according to his mind. Now, up to a certain point, you see that the Russia is pretty much doing the same thing, even though he has a false ideology, you know, an idealist is an idealist. Idealist up to a certain point. I mean, I'm not trying to bolster the idealist, don't get me wrong, but you have to understand the reality that the idealist is also somebody who doesn't live according to his tithes. He has to live a very Spartan existence, and there's a lot of superficial similarities. Even Hitler, Yimach Shemo, he didn't indulge in the tithes. He was very determined, and determination and discipline and, you know, having the ability to sustain a long-term battle for something. For years, he came out of nowhere. He was a complete nothing and total unknown. Dropout, a flunk out. I mean, and he worked his way up and he became the mightiest ruler. That takes tremendous qualities. So up to a certain point, it's the same idea that and along the way, he many, many things occur which go contrary to his emotions and would fill a person with anger, but he's able to take it. He takes the bumps, he takes the insults, and he knows how to deal with it. So, what's the difference between the Tzaddik and the Rosh? Of course, aside from the fact that one is, I'm not asking on that level, the Rosh's ideology, the fourth one. I'm talking about on a personal level, because we're trying to understand why the Tzaddik needs and the Derech HaShem Tovei. What's different about them on a subjective level, on a psychological level? Very important point over here. The Russia can control his emotions, but he can only do so up to a point. Because at bottom, he's all about emotion. His basic nature is to satisfy certain emotions. So he's able to control his emotions in order to get to a certain point. But there will come a point in time when he can't control his emotions anymore, and he's going to operate according to emotion. But because he doesn't have a true ideal. There is no real ideal. It's a masquerade. The ideal is nothing other than a cover for a certain very powerful emotion. So he's got to come a point in time when he's going to be completely consumed by those emotions. But the tzaddik lives in a different world. He doesn't value the world of the emotions. He's someone, like I mentioned, the Rambam says it with regard to the Navi, but I mean, it's the tzaddik as well. That he's Kovesh, as Yisro, Bedaito, Tomid. That's a difference. Now we understand that even more significantly, that it's not just that he can control his emotions, but he's Kovesh, as Yisro, Bedaito. Because he values truth. So he's able to control his emotions in every situation. So now if you look at it, what happened that night is very, very fascinating. I mean, Esther's plan. She set into motion certain psychological processes. And I can't say at this point in time, you know, she had a general idea, but the plan worked in conjunction with the Hashgacha, and she opened certain doors. I don't know exactly, it's hard to say what exactly her intentions were and what she was hoping to. It's clearly, in terms of Ahasuerus, it's obvious what she was hoping to achieve, I mean, to arouse certain fears within him. Certain suspicions, because you see that he couldn't sleep that night, and immediately couldn't sleep. He wanted to read the record book to find out the history of what was going on, and you see that she had aroused certain fears in him and certain suspicions, which had to do with Haman. That was clear. But now, so that seems to be the reason why she brings Haman there, but it had other psychological consequences. It was multi-layered. That was the major effect, but it wasn't the only effect, because that night is very, very significant, and that night is the downfall of Haman. You see a completely different type of Haman. What caused him to be outraged? Samech v'tov lev. He was in a great, great mood. You see? But that's precisely the point. See, a person is able to control his emotions when he's striving for a certain type of a success. You see this all over the, you know, like in business, you see actors, you see musicians, till they reach the goal. So then they're able to hold all the emotions in check, and because they haven't reached the goal yet. But then you see, once they reach the goal and they're beginning to, now they're beginning to allow the emotions to be gratified, that's a completely different state. Now, psychologically, I think each guy can relate to this in his own life. See, there's a difference, like for many people, like I'll just use any example that comes to mind, like with dieting, that it's easier. Many people will tell you that it's easier for them when they're losing the weight, but they go on a very strict diet. But they're a very strict diet where you basically are fasting even, and you're only eating and drinking some minimal stuff. So even though it would seem that that's much more difficult and painful, that's easier for them than the next phase, the phase of maintenance. You know, now they've lost the weight, now they go back to maintenance, and now they have to eat a certain amount, and then you have to stop in the middle. So that's harder. It's easier, even though at the beginning it may be more painful, it's easier to refrain completely than from moderate indulgence. That the real perfection is the Scottish asnucha b'mutterwach, to sanctify yourself in the realm of the mutter. The realm of the prohibited is easier, because you just make a decision. For example, people smoke. It's easier to just go cold turkey, get up cigarettes, you'll have pain for a few days, and that's it. But to be moderate, to smoke a few and then withdraw, that's much, much harder. The question is why? See, because there's different states with regard to the emotions. There's the emotion in a state of frustration. So that's annoying, that creates certain pressure. But if a person works on it, he can deal with it, he can conquer it. Then there's the emotion when it's in the process of being satisfied. That's the most difficult thing, to stop. Because now, when it's in a state of deprivation, the person still has a control over it, a certain distance from it. I'm assuming, sometimes the point the deprivation is so painful that he can't take it. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking in a general sense. There's even a halacha like that. The Rambam reads, I think it's in Yisurei Bia. I'm not sure exactly where right now, but I was remembering it this morning when I was thinking about this. That, if a woman is an Eishes Ish, a woman is, it says, obviously, if she has Bia, so then she becomes Nesar to her husband, and she's Chayav Misa, the whole thing. But if she's raped, so she's not chayav, not her fault. But I think he mentions that even if in the middle she says rotsani, that she doesn't want to stop, so she's considered to be an onus. Because once you're in the middle of the in that situation where the taiva is being satisfied, so that's already not considered to be baratsan anymore. That's like too overpowering. So what happened that night is that he was able to indulge all of his emotions. This is what he's living for. He's living for this simcha, for this joy. So when he was in that state of emotion, he was not, up until that point, he had to be in complete control of his emotions because he was moving up the ladder. And when he was in that state of mind, he was in a state of rational control. But once he was able, when he left that party, he was in a state where he was completely captivated by the emotions. And when he was completely captivated by the emotions, then he couldn't tolerate it. Because that's really why he hated Mordechai. Because the thing, of course, it's an ideological thing. It's an ideological thing. Once he decides that he can't tolerate it. But why he can't tolerate it is because he can't enjoy. It's not just that one person I mentioned before, one person didn't bow down to. That one person represents reality. Because a certain part of his psyche, he's at war with himself. He's not crazy. He's not insane. He's manifesting something. He's living by some idea which is insane, which is an insanity. But that's an emotion. But on a certain level, he also recognizes that he's not what he claims to be, that he's just an ordinary mortal, that he's a nothing. That's the other side. So the only way out of the conflict for the Russia is to repress that side of him which recognizes that this is crazy. And that's why everybody has to, the opinions of the adulation of the masses becomes reality for him. That's the reality he lives in. That's the Hitler gave these speeches and all these Germans, Heil Hitler. I mean, that becomes reality. But Mordechai is someone who's saying, "Well, calm below zombie man, this is nothing. This is insanity." That activates the insecurity within Haman himself, and that prevents him from having any kind of a pleasure. That's what happened on that night. This was the Melech B'Tov Lev. Now he's experiencing all the emotional gratification that he's been striving for all these years. So he's in a purely emotional state. When he was in a purely emotional state, then he couldn't take it. Then he saw Mordechai Yehudi, below Kam, below Zarimata, he destroyed his pleasure. And that's exactly what he says. He comes home, he barely could control himself. But you can see the downfall, because from this point on, he's acting purely by emotion, by instinct. He's not the same person anymore. He would never have done any of these things at a different time if he wasn't under the control of the emotions. Now let's go down the list. First of all, he calls together his friends. I don't think he ever convened that group before, because he wasn't looking for intellectual and for intelligent advice. These were people that were going to tell him what he wants. Of people that are neutral, but very often a guy will go to his friends and he'll tell them his side, because he knows that these people are going to back him up. So that was the stupidest thing to do, to gather a gathering of ohavav. So now he's really in danger, because now he's making himself vulnerable to purely emotional advice. Now the advice that they give him is what? Something which was emotionally very pleasing, but it was very dangerous. It was extreme. Why was it dangerous? The advice. The advice was, "Batomalo Zeresh Ishto V'chalava." That's also very fascinating, because it mentions Zeresh first. You see? Interesting. I'm just in the pasuk. In pasuk Yud, Vayevo Beisav Yishlach Vayave Es Ohavav via Zeresh Ishto, his friends and his wife Zeresh. In terms of the giving of the advice, I mean, the worst person is Zeresh, you know, your own wife Zeresh Ishto, because she's just going to be completely. I mean, she's going to be emotional. Women tend to be more emotional, and it's your wife. In mentioning the advice, it mentions that first, and they went along with it. So you see, it was a purely emotional response, which had absolutely no seichel, because what was it? And they'll hang him on it. In other words, what was the whole purpose of this plan? So you can enjoy. You see, when it gets down to it, this guy who had tremendous discipline, tremendous control, and now he's a complete slave to his next emotional need. He's having a party tomorrow night. He's got to enjoy it. This is in his way. And he's got to get rid of it. And without any thoughts of the consequences. Interestingly enough, I just noticed it. Even with their advice, it said that he should wait until the morning. Doesn't say, right? To wait until the morning. Huh? Hello?
Yeah.
Right? But that's not what he did. Even that bit of restraint, even that would have been helpful, because he would have avoided the consequences of that night. That night was very significant. When he did it, but he couldn't even wait till the morning. See, then it tells you now he goes to the king. That was very, very bad. Why was it very bad to go to the king?
That shows the king is emotional.
Yeah, because first of all, you're right. He's breaking down his plan. This is a crucial element in his plan, was to keep his personal emotional stake totally hidden and to make it purely objective. So now by going to the king, to deviate from that plan, doesn't matter even when, to deviate from that plan was stupid. The plan was a smart plan. And he worked out the plan when he was in a different emotional state. Now, to go that night, they told him at least to wait until the morning, which would have been better. Because in the morning, you know, a person, no matter what's bothering him, things look different the next morning. So the smartest thing for anybody would have been to say, let's sleep on it. They at least said, they gave him the plan, but at least they said, let's sleep on it. Because they said, in the morning, no one said go back right now. Now is the worst time to do anything. You don't do anything now. See, this is in contrast to the Derech of the Tzaddik, like Esther. When Esther finally accepted what Mordechai, you know, had said that she has to go, the first thing she did was she didn't do anything. She didn't go in that state. She took 3 days of tshuva and tainus and recognizing that I can't just jump in front of the king. I got to work things out. But he didn't even wait until the morning. You shouldn't do anything in that state. A person has to recognize that I'm not in a state to do anything right now. He couldn't even recognize that. But moreover, he's going into something now where it's completely dark. He doesn't know what state of mind the king is in. Now, usually a person in politics tries to get as much insight, intelligence. Before he does anything, he speaks to the advisors. Everything else that he did was done in that manner. Now he's just going in blind. See, he's completely ruled by emotion. He's going in blind. You don't know what state of mind the king is in. You don't know where he's at. It just so happened, of course, that the Ashkacha was being very cooperative, that it happened to be that the king couldn't sleep. It happened to be that he was reading the history books. It also happened to be that he completely forgot. He forgot that he had not rewarded Mordechai, when Mordechai had saved the life of the king. And this became the basis of the king's anger now against Haman. But the worst thing in the world was for Haman to appear. And notice also, he came there with the objective of, you know, telling the, I don't know how he was going to present it to him, but anyhow, to tell him to kill Mordechai, but he never got a chance even to say that. That's what's interesting about it. Because when he came there, you see, and that was his mistake, he should not have gone there in the first place, because you don't know what you're going to find. You don't know what the king is up to. And then when he asks him what to do, Manasa, and the king, you see, the king was activated. Generally, Achashverosh was depicted as being pretty passive, but he's not a fool either. He's a king. And the strategy of Esther had really gotten him thinking, got bothered him thinking, and he found this, he was checking the records. And he discovered something about this character, about Haman. And he asked a very, very shrewd question. And, you know, what should the king do to somebody who he wants to glorify, who he wants to honor? And there, too, he made a tremendous, tremendous mistake. He just followed his impulse. It has to be me. You see, all of the sophistication, all of the brilliance, all of the planning is out the window, and he's operating purely by the next emotion that hits him. That's the downfall of every Russia. That's Hitler at the end, or ordering armies around and this and that, imaginary units that didn't exist. I mean, he's completely out of the realm of reality. And the most crucial mistake is he openly revealed what his desires were. That was a setup. The king set him up, and he completely, you see, the mistake was that he underestimated the significance. So a guy is completely caught up with himself and his own greatness. He's looking at things from the perspective of his own emotions. So everything he does is fantastic. And he completely negates the effect that what he is saying is going to have on somebody else, the psychological effect, the psychological impact. So that was the downfall of Haman. The downfall of Haman is the Derech Rishoyim Toved, that his whole effectiveness, his whole ability to get anywhere was dependent upon the ability to control the emotion and to disguise it and to hide it and to make something which is extremely egotistical appear to be very idealistic. And that can only be temporary, because at bottom, the emotion will come out. And when he'll find himself in an emotional state. And when he finds himself in an emotional state, when the thing that he's been longing for is in a state of being satisfied, that's when he falls apart. And then the emotion will completely take over his mind. That's what happened over there. It's not insignificant that he had aroused the anger of the king, and he was walking. The fact that, how important is it in the scheme of things that when he gave the answer, you know, the answer was that because he thought it was himself, that he should dress up in the king's garments and he should ride on the king's horse and somebody should lead him, say, Kachi Yasalish, you know, the Hashem Chafetz Bikaro. So then, what does he say? He says, okay, go and do that for Mordechai Yehudi. I mean, so why did Ahasuerus force Haman? Why did Haman have to be the one to do that? Why didn't he get somebody else to do it? But you see already that this is the beginning of the end. That his whole position rested on the ability to maintain a certain type of a relationship with Ahasuerus. That Ahasuerus was the person of indulgence, of hedonism, and the kind of person that really didn't want to be bothered with all the details of running the country, and that's why he needed a guy like Haman, a guy that, to the contrary, he likes the authority and the power and the, and he's concerned about the that's the relationship that forms between them. That really was the strategy of Esther. She recognized that there's a certain relationship between them. And that she has to be. She couldn't just go to the king and say that Haman. She couldn't just go to the king and say that Haman is an evil person, because at that point in time he had put all his confidence in Haman. What are you talking about? Haman is the most loyal servant, and whatever he does for the sake of the kingdom. She understood that. That's why she had a plan. She needed time. She needed to plant seeds of doubt. Most significant thing that she did was to plant seeds of doubt. That this guy, Haman, is he really doing all of this because he's so loyal and dedicated to you? Or he has his own ambition, and once his ambition is satisfied, you'll be out of it just like everybody else. That's what she was trying to plant the seed. And indeed, that's what he found. That's what bothered him about the fact that Mordechai had not been rewarded. Because why didn't you reward Mordechai? Oh, because he's Jewish. So what's the difference? If you really cared about me, that's extremely important, because the king always has to worry about enemies, about a plot, about a conspiracy. So if somebody comes forth and reveals it and saves the king, that person has to be set up as an example for the whole people, so everybody else will want to give information the next time they hear about something. And you failed to do that. That was a very serious failure. But that was basically what, in a general sense, that's what Esther was trying to achieve. Set the stage so that when she was ready to accuse Haman of being someone who's purely out for his own interest, that to the contrary, the Jews are the loyal servants, the groundwork had been prepared. That's why the importance of that night, that Haman had lost something in the psyche, in the unconscious, whatever you want to call it. In other words, he had achieved a certain image in the eyes of the king. That was his whole success. His ladder to power was through the king at that point. But he wouldn't have been happy just to stay at that level. I mean, because an egomaniac and a person who deifies himself, eventually he would want to destroy the king. There's never enough. But at that point in time, he needed the king, and his whole modus operandi was to convince him that he's completely loyal to the king and to the kingdom. And he's been very, very successful. Because that's why he was a Rasha. A Rasha has tremendous kochos, tremendous abilities. But what happened on that night was, as I said, he was completely transformed from a state of control to a state of indulgence. The emotion was now in a state of indulgence. And in that state, he confronted Mordechai, and Mordechai brought out that anger, and now once that anger took hold, he was completely devastated. He was now completely captivated by emotion, and every step that he made from that point on that night was going further and further towards his own destruction. That's the idea of a Derech Hashem Tovet, that it's not always of course, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, but it's not always that God intervenes and destroys him, but it means that's what you see. That's what you see from the Megillah. bolsters what we discussed on Friday, that the Jews were able to see the derech of Chachma, derech of an Esther, how she operates with Chachma, the derech of Mordechai, that it's not just a temporary ability to control an emotion in a given situation, but it's an overarching thing. It's people that are always Moshe al-Yitzo b'daito with their knowledge to live a life purely in accordance with Chachma. Yeah, the other people are successful. That's the big attraction, success. So look at Haman. Look at Hitler taking over the world. But Derech Hashem Tovid, they were able to see. And eventually they were able to understand that it wasn't like in Kriyas Yamsuf where God intervened and just destroyed them. Now, that's one thing. Of course, that means God's the greatest power. But you don't see the ideas in real life. The derech of the tzaddik as opposed to the derech of the rasha. That's the idea of a derech Hashem Tovid. Okay?
Yep.
Right, man?
Yeah.
Question. It seems to be that Haman would not have just wanted to kill Mordechai. It seems to be the only reason why he wanted to do it is because of Zeresh Ishto Ve'Kol Ohavo. It was their advice.
Right.
So,
well, I mean, no, that's what he really wanted.
Right, but
that's what he really wanted. But
he wouldn't have done it without their approval, though. It seems to be that the clincher.
It's not. Well, yes, they. That's how Russia operates. They, strengthen the emotion. They gave him the support. Yeah, everybody agrees with it. Most people have advisors. Most people want a certain support. Well, I mean, see this also, because he recognized that it was an emotional thing. When you get into an argument with someone. So you run to your friends and you tell your side of the story. So if it's a good friend, a chacham, so he'll sit down with you and he'll tell you the objective thing, that you're wrong. If it's not a good friend and he just wants to please you, so then it'll satisfy your emotions. You good?
Yeah, it seems to be that for the Russia, the only way to lose that, the one thing that makes him lose that aspect of rationality is the approval of the other people.
Right.
That once the... Without other people, apparently it would not be strong enough. He needs people in order to.
Oh yeah, well that's his only reality. His only reality is people,
right?
Because the idea is absurd. The idea is absurd, and but if you can convince, you can convince the whole nation that I live, whether you're something superior, then You can believe it yourself.
Right. It's the people which create his feelings.
Yes.
Everything depends upon other people.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
It's
of course.
All relativistic.
It's all relative. That's the Derech Hashem Tovid. But I just wanted to make the contrast that in order to reach a certain level, he has to be operating like the tzaddik, so to speak, with discipline, with control. That's the contrast. That here you see a complete change from the Haman who was able to convince Mordechai to. To put his plan into effect. He got what he wanted. He wanted to wipe out all the Jews because he believed that, that they were the real enemy. It's true because they won't accept his concept that he has some power over reality here. True. But you see how he operated completely differently. And on that night, it wasn't the same person anymore. But I'm saying that's just not a particular... That's part of the universal thing. That's why it's the Derech Hashem Tovid, that the Russia will be successful, but temporarily. Because eventually, since his idealism is not a true idealism, it's just a different emotion, he's able to restrain himself and operate rationally, just like a Chacham does, but only up to a point. As opposed to the true Chacham, who's Moshe al-Yabadaito al-Yisro Tamit. That's a different thing.
It could also be, I was just wondering, because we said that the reason why he didn't kill Mordechai originally
is
because he didn't want to make it look in a certain way in the eyes of other people.
Well, I mean, obviously.
Right.
But that's what we're saying.
Right.
No, you're saying it's different.
Right.
He couldn't reveal. He was very good at hiding his true intentions.
Right.
He would not reveal. And but you see the extent that he was able to put up with the lack of respect.
Right.
But you see that over here he had the matzah now, because now the people said you should do it.
No, it's not. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. That's not my main point. I'm saying the main reason is what I tried to explain. That there comes a point in time where you can't control the emotion anymore. That was that night. That was a consequence of Esther's party. Now, I don't know if it was intended or unintended. Because it would seem that bringing Haman there would, her main reason, her primary reason, was the effect it would have on Ahasuerus' emotion. Her idea was to manipulate the emotions of the participants that she had to deal with. You see, she took 3 days. She stepped aside. She studied the situation purely objectively, and she had the element of surprise. They had no idea what they were getting into with those parties, neither one of them. Now, I don't know, after she had to invite Haman, I'm not saying she invited Haman because she was able to foresee that this would happen. I mean, that's the rule. To know, it just means that a tzaddik, a person acts with chachma, so that it's not just the intended consequences. Sometimes it even has unintended consequences because you're operating with reality. If you're operating in line with reality, so your plan is going to be more successful, and it may be successful on levels that you yourself didn't even anticipate. So it may be that she, you know, how much can a person anticipate? That she would know that he would, I'm not saying that she knew, I'm not saying that she knew that Ahasuerus wouldn't be able to fall asleep that night. You can't predict that. But the idea that he'd be bothered, that he'd be troubled, what's going on over here, this never happened before, that she knew. She couldn't know the particulars. The idea that it would have an effect upon Haman, to the extent that she considered that, because she had to consider that too. I'm bringing Haman in there, but to that extent, she realized that that would also be good because that would put him off guard, put him completely off guard. It made sense. I'm sure that she analyzed every aspect of the plan. And once she decided that this was a good idea to have just those two people at a party, and then not to tell them, because she knew the king would ask, what is it? And not to tell them and to have them come back the second time. Not all she planned all of that. To the extent, but she had to ask herself the question, what effect would it have on Haman? Maybe it's better, maybe I should invite him to the first, maybe I should. She thought that through, that A, she needed him to be there to arouse the suspicions of Ahasuerus, but B, it could only be a good thing because she knew the real character of Haman, that he was on Malek, and that this would throw him off guard too, because it would put him in a completely different direction. I mean, to the extent that you calculate what effect your actions are going to have on the other person, which is the Derech of the Tzaddik, it would make sense that even though she couldn't predict the particulars, but she could predict in general that it would put him in a different, it would bring up very powerful emotions. This is what he wanted. And the suspense of it, and who knows what's happening over here. He didn't know. And this would put him in a completely emotional state, so that's better for her plan. That she's throwing him in a completely different direction, and he's going to be unprepared for the reality, totally unprepared for the reality of what he's going to face the next night. Now, it just so happened that the particular effect of it worked better than she could have imagined. That as he walks out, he sees Mordechai, and then it triggers this tremendous anger, and then he calls Zeresh. All these things were a result of what she did, but I'm saying it's unintended because I'm not saying she had Nebuah and she knew that. That's not the case. But she operated with Chachma, and the plan that's based upon Chachma works. And as I said, it works not just on one level that you can think of, it works on many levels.
Okay,
anything else?
Was that actually part of the plan that Mordechai would be right out there as soon as Haman left the
mission? I thought, I don't know the specifics because we don't know the specifics. But in general, the Megillah says that he would make a point of being there all the time. So there's no reason to assume that he wouldn't. All I'm saying is that I don't think that this particular, what actually did occur, that he left and he saw, I mean, it's always possible. You don't assume that Mordechai just stayed there 24 hours a day. And, Mordechai, he could leave to take care of some business. So there's the Ashkacha. You follow? I don't know that she knew because she didn't tell Mordechai to be there. If you're going to go so far, which I think is very difficult because you know, you can predict certain things in general, but certain particularities, unless you have the vua. And it doesn't say that she told him to be there, that that was the plan. That's like, you know, there's no need to say all of that. There's no need to say. Her idea was the correct idea, to put him in a completely different emotional state, in which he would be very vulnerable because he'd be completely expecting the opposite. And then he'd get hit with this blow. That seems to be the general. But Balayla, oh, that's the Gemara says, that's the story of the Ashkacha. Prepared. Everything was prepared in terms of the psyche of the king, in terms of the underlying attitude that he had towards Haman, the respect that he had for him, the trust that he had for him. All of that has been completely uprooted. So now the ground was paved. So then when she made her accusation, the king was, that basically was the last straw, so to speak. He was ready. He was ready to hear it. And I think that was the general idea of the strategy of Esther. All right, guys. Have a good